Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to the Kitchen Garden Magazine podcast, your fortnightly fix of gardening features, advice, and chat. Subscribe and follow us now to never miss an episode.
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of On the Grapevine, with me, your host, Daniel Hayes, and my guest today, kitchen gardener and speaker, Helena Dove.
How are you today then? Has the rain got up to you yet?
It's drizzling, but it's all right. Like, workable. My trainee's out in it, so it's all right.
Yeah, I think, because I did pop up on Friday and I saw the young Scottish girl. She was mulching all the beds. Yes, she has had fun. It did look very nice. I do like a mulched bed. Some people are a bit like, oh, it's got to be being used at all points. But I quite like a nice, freshly mulched bed. I think it looks nice, to be honest.
It's about the only time that it looks perfect. So, like, you know, that kind of just mulched, like, no badgers dug it up. No one's stood in it. Like, that's the perfect time, if you ask
me. It lasts for a couple of hours until some bloke turns up and treads on it. And, oh, I suppose you get a nice picture.
Or we were looking at it and, like, so the half that she's done, it's just been so sunny, it started to dry out. So that's gone one colour, and the stuff that she's done today is a different colour. And that's, like, when you've got a little bit of OCD about it, it's like, oh, that's so frustrating. But
oh, dear, you could be in trouble on a veg garden then. Get OCD.
Well, you don't have OCD for long, but just you know, sometimes you just look out for it. You get those moments, don't you, when you look out the kitchen garden and it looks like the kitchen garden you planned and you hoped for. Those moments are really beautiful but rare, because quite often you'll look out and then you'll notice that something's fallen down or something's got a disease.
Or some little creatures appeared and you're like, oh, that wasn't there an hour ago.
I've never had pest issues the way I've had them in the last year and a bit, I have to say, but keeps me on my toes.
Oh, it's fun, because you use quite a thick, quite a coarse mulch, don't you? Because when I was there the other day, someone said, oh, there's loads of branches in it. I think he was over-exaggerating on the branches, but it is quite compared to what you might think it would be.
So we have two types of mulch, which we only use in the kitchen garden, soft mulch, which is really finely shredded, but not as finely as, it's not compost, which is what people are expecting. And then we do have, in the evolution garden around it, that's the woody mulch, and that is really thick mulch, but we put that on really hard, like really thickly. The stuff in the kitchen garden this year is, it's winter, so there's a real like fight for the end of the summer mulch, which is like really fine. And then obviously autumn, you're putting in leaves and twigs. So then the stuff that's coming out now is a little coarser. But actually what we do is we rake it a couple of times, take out funny thing too massive, but we don't direct sow. So it's not a massive problem.
No.
So it's fine and it all rots down and, you know.
Well, that's what I explained to the chap. I said, funny enough, the plants, vegetables don't care, because the things that they want, you can't see. You might think a piece of dirt, people might just think, oh, that's got nothing good in it. Well, actually might be full of something amazing for obviously certain plants, like certain things. Hence, brassicas love clay, where most gardens, I do no dig and haven't done it for about 20 years. But that's just because I'm lazy. But I don't tend to think that it's been proven now by Charles Dowden that it makes, it doesn't. In fact, it probably to the detriment of your vegetable plot?
Well, when we've spoken to some of our science, we don't have soil scientists as such here, but when we speak to our mycologists and folk like that, they completely agree that the science is definitely don't disturb your soil. But even when you think about no dig, you think about what happens in nature, like the animals deal with the top layer and no one's digging it in. And you've got a much healthier soil if it looks after itself, it's more resilient. I mean, just everything about no dig makes sense to me. I understand why ground has been dug over for years and years and years. I see what's happened and I understand it, and I'm not, gonna shout at people for it, but for myself it just makes more sense and it's easier. As you say, it's a sort of lazy, I've been told to stop saying lazy, it's efficient. It's an efficient way of managing the soil.
I can dig it over, but you need to be efficient, obviously. This is the thing. Whereas because it's for me, myself, it's a thing. I know some people do. I remember chatting to Adam Frost and he likes digging it over because he says it's a great way of getting whatever's angsting him. And as I say, there's no right, no wrong. It's the same as crop rotation. Right. It's been pretty, I mean, that's a big thing, but that was mainly by farmers who were probably overdid a piece of land and kept pushing it, getting every bit. So, of course, they had to rotate because they ended up just killing the land off.
Yeah.
But you don't really need to do it in a small sense, I don't think.
No, and you definitely don't with no dig because you're replacing the top layer. So, most veg, they don't have the longest roots compared to like perennials, for example. No. So, I do, when people are digging in compost or manure or whatever, down to 6 foot or something, spits depth, that's not where the roots are. So like by putting the mulch on the top, you're giving them the nutrients.
Let the worms do the work, Helena, that's what I say.
And the trainee, no, you're one of those. But no, like it's easier and it makes more sense to me.
Yeah.
And we do copy a lot of horticulture comes from agriculture, a lot of it.
Yes.
And so when you par it back and you realise you're doing different, it's different. It's not the same thing. So why would you copy them exactly? But also look at agriculture now. A lot of them are having to add back nutrients because they've dug. There's a real focus on carbon lockup, so they're trying to not dig over. So it, in an odd way, it's kind of twisted back. So the agriculturalists are looking at what the horticulturalists are doing. And,
things go, like the world goes in, weather patterns go in. I mean, around this area, you go back to the 60s, we'd have had 6 foot snowdrifts and they weren't, do you know what I mean? It wasn't an unknown thing around here. But of course, but I think everything goes in a circle. And as you say, I suppose a lot of it is people copy what their forefathers or foremothers did, say. And as you say, it just takes obviously someone to say, is there a better way? I think you're right. Yeah. Is there a more efficient way? And I think this is the thing nowadays is it's all about efficiency. And also large-scale agriculture doing it for money purposes. They're not necessarily doing it for the purposes of the ground and the world around you. They're more interested in what's my profit.
Yeah, and you've got to feed countries full of people. So, it is really, but no dig is, I mean, I've never really dug over the soil. I did it in my level 2 RHS, as you were forced to. I got marked on it and I did fine.
I must admit, I've been a gardener 35 years and I've never done an RHS course in my life.
I think I failed quite quickly. they don't do it anymore. This was ages ago when I was doing it. And I tell you what, double digging in the middle of winter on clay soil was just, horrible.
A bit younger than me. The thing is how it's changed a bit. I mean, I'm knocking on 50 now. In fact, next year I will be. There wasn't really the options to do horticulture much when I went to Marysfield College back in the late 80s. And there wasn't much choice. It was I've got an HND in habitat management, which is as close as you're going to get to it. But there was nothing involving growing flowers, shrubs, things like that. They're kind of shrubs are kind of like, they're over there things. We're more interested in. So I can manage your forest and your heathlands, but the world's changed now. And it's almost, it's a real viable option to become. Years ago, gardeners were like, well, what do you want to do? Well, I don't really know what I want to do. Well, you can be a gardener. And it was a bit of a kind of like, well, just be a gardener. Whereas now, actually, it's a real, you can actually have a really good career and it's got decent earning prospects as well. Because that was always the problem. It's a bit like, it's all right, but it's not the best paid job in the world, gardening. But now it's a good option.
And there's so many, There's lots of different arms, you know. You do a slightly different arm to what I do, and there are benefits to both. And the more you get into it, I think the more you do discover there are lots of different pathways. Like, even I get people coming in here and going, oh, so you're a gardener. And I was like, oh, I'm the kitchen gardener. Oh, well, I didn't know you could do just kitchen, you know, just veg growing professionally. And, you know, look what I do compared to what a market gardener does, which is entirely different again. So it's just like there are so many niches, and it's great, and they are more open.
And you've got the thing which I remember in when I was at college is, do you manage it for the wildlife or for amenity? And it's finding the happy balance. You obviously have to make it look nice because people come to see you. So it's not your own. You might think, I don't really like doing that, but I've got to do it, unfortunately, because it's what's not expected, but people are coming to see it and they don't really want to see it.
It's the aim of the garden. I've always said that any garden, you can achieve three things. Like, there's so many things that my garden could be. So for me, the first thing is ornamental, because it's a tourist attraction. People are coming to see. Second thing is education. I want people to take away, you know, what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. And then the third thing is, it's a productive area. So I produce for the restaurants and for a little sale. But say, for example, a community allotment on site, which is for community, well, the priority there isn't the look, isn't the ornamental, it's actually the learning. So I think you can do three things really well in any space, but three things only. And you have to decide what's the priority. So that's kind of always been my, you know, people kind of have come in with these great ideas we could do with the space, but I know that if I tried to do a fourth thing, I wouldn't do anything very well. So it's kind of, you decide what your area wants. You know, at home, the priority is low maintenance. Can I have a gin and tonic while I wander around with a hoe? That's what the priority is there. You know, it's different.
We've got your number now. Gin and tonic. It needs to look nice because it's my garden and I have a wife and children who'd soon let me know if it looked messy. But it's just nice that after all these years, I've got an allotment just out on my back door. So it's great. I can go out of an evening where before I'd have to go and unlock all the gates, drive down there, walk to the bottom. Unfortunately, about 20 people stop you. Hello, Dan. Have a quick chat. And you finally find, I've been here 45 minutes and I've not even actually got to my allotment. So it's quite nice. It makes me sound like a miserable old man, actually. But there you go. It's to the goodness of my plants.
No, I'm quite a solitary gardener. We don't open at a minute till 10 o'clock and we start at 7:30. And that's 2.5 hours where you can just get your head down and bob on with it. It's lovely. I mean, you know, visitors are great as well, but to be able to just kind of sit and concentrate and it's really sweet. And
get things done is the thing. It's nice chatting to people, but if people keep stopping, you suddenly look at what you think, should have done this by now, and then suddenly something else is pressing you and you're like, oh, I'm never gonna get there.
The biggest skill I learned when I started public gardening was to work and talk at the same time. People don't always get me eye contact, but I will answer their questions. But you know, if you've got a tray of veg or something in the heat, you just need to get it in the ground. So yeah, it's the first thing I taught my trainee is how to work and talk. It's vital.
Very vital, I'd imagine, yeah. Because how do you find, because you had pretty, because I think you started last, when did you get hold of it? I can't remember, was it last May or April?
The kitchen garden, so the new version of the kitchen garden, So I've been here for 5 years and the kitchen garden's been here for 10 now. But this time last year it was completely empty and we were tearing the turf out and putting it elsewhere. So yeah, I got it back in, well, I got back on site on May and we opened in June.
So it's a very untypical English summer, which as you say, because I say, it must have given you some interesting highlights and some probably other things that maybe you might call low lights, I suppose. But it was a harsh old year for a new garden, because I dare say it probably had diggers and etc and things,
it had diggers,
plant machinery going over it.
They were really respectful, actually. There's a company we work with quite a lot, and they're pretty good. They mainly only roll over the paths. But also, because we've got two really amazing old trees, we couldn't dig down very far. So actually, we raised it up a little bit. So it wasn't too bad. So most of the beds are soil from the old paths, so the beds aren't too compact. But
yeah,
I've not had problems with compaction. It's more just getting to know a new site in the middle of a growing season, which was quite a nightmare, with all eyes on you. You know, this was the year of food at Kew, and I was the new kitchen garden, and I was just going, oh, I don't know what's happening. Just kind of things went in much later than I would normally get them in. Mentioned previously, I've never had badger problems, and turns out they think it's hilarious to, you know, you put your new rhubarb in and then they'll pull it out again and then you put it in again. And I lost that war. I lost all my rhubarb last year, but I just put some new in. And just things like, it was so hot that the asparagus went in, but it didn't establish. So it has done okay. But it might be, rather than 2 years now until I harvest it, we might wait a third because it had a really poor start in the year. So the heat, and planting things in June that I would normally plant out in May.
Yeah.
It was all quite hectic, but it's great.
Very nice, though, when I came up in September, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So it looked very nice. Because I noticed when I came back the other day, I don't know if you're growing your gourds and from Bicinos, because I know she put apples in your lovely arches.
Yeah. So that was always the plan. We've always had kind of, you know, you can't do everything in the first year. And I've learned from bitter experience not try to. So, yeah, we wanted to grow up fruit. We have a little orchard at Kew, hidden away. But I wanted to grow up.
The door was private. Yes, that's it.
Oh, no, the orchard's up in, the orchard's actually up in Queens. So it's in a different area of the garden.
You must have your greenhouses hidden.
Yes, I have a greenhouse hidden away in the corner. We have
best place to hide. Yeah, best place to hide, I imagine.
Also, it's a good place to just work, you know, have a cup of tea. The apples are now going to go over the arch. They're going to be grown as cordons because we don't have a big kitchen garden. I mean, we have a big kitchen garden compared to my back garden, but it's actually only about 1/4 acre. So it's not a ginormous site. So everything has to be restricted. So all the fruit's restricted.
Yeah, interesting, because I've been to Wisley as well, because they've had their new world kitchen garden. I've got to think of all the names. You're edible science, aren't you? They're not just kitchen gardens.
We all call it a kitchen gardens at the end of the day.
Yeah, but you've probably got more growing, although they have a bigger area. Actually, you've probably got more growing space than them per se.
Yeah, when they were designing it, I, in my own sweet way, got involved and sort of really put them off doing smaller beds. Because smaller beds are great in terms of, like, you can show what you can do in a small space, but it's very restrictive. You know, if you can't grow squash in an amazing fashion, but also the more you have space-wise, the more flexibility you have. So we have a few smaller beds at about 6x2, but I didn't want fancy shapes because, you know, I've grown before in a space that had lots of angular beds, and those little corners dry out. You can't grow anything in it. It's quite frustrating. So I wanted the maximum of just plain. It was basically a designer's nightmare. I just wanted as plain as possible and water points everywhere. That was my big thing. I was like, how many water points can I have?
Well, you've got a thing there because you're part walled garden, really, aren't you? You're not wholly walled in, but you're part walled garden, which is quite nice. So you get an interesting.
I suppose
you do, because I've noticed the other day the sun comes up, so it's fairly southernish facing, isn't it?
It's really an
interesting thing that a lot of people don't normally necessarily, either in a wall garden or not, where you've kind of got a nice and you use a lot of vertical, and rather a lot of people think it's horizontal, but you've shown there with a lot of vertical, there's a lot of space wasted by people, because obviously a lot of things can grow upwards that you wouldn't necessarily think can grow upwards.
Yeah, we started it this last year, and it's going to continue. We have one of the smaller beds is looking at growing in smaller spaces. And one of the aspects is looking at vertical growing. So, for example, my favourite crop this year, I think, was Malabar spinach, which did really, really well. And that's a climbing plant that produces it's quite drought tolerant. It likes the heat. But the fact that it's spinach that grows up, I mean, you were just getting very little in basically a 50 centimeter squared space.
Is that
it was amazing.
Foot square bed?
It was in there,
It will soon outgrow that. I thought spinach. It will soon be out of going next door now. Yeah.
I think vertical growing is really, really important. And And also, the kitchen gardens are quite flat spaces otherwise. And although the kitchen garden has got a wall around it, what you don't see very often is right at the very end of where would have been the old kitchen garden is now the end of Evolution Garden. There's a big mound. And what the wind does, and we do get the wind, it comes sailing over that mound and it misses everything and it hits the kitchen garden. So having vertical...
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The structures actually breaks up the wind that I get from that direction. So yeah, because it doesn't feel like it's a windy site. It is quite covered and it isn't windy compared to some sites that I've worked on. Like I'm not comparing it to like an open site in Norwich somewhere, for example, but we still get this wind when it hits. And so you do need the vertical structures to kind of break it up and make shadow. And also, you know, there's crops like lettuces that struggle in the middle of summer because it's so hot. So if you've got vertical structures, you can grow them in the shade of kind of your beans and stuff. And they don't bolt so fast. So, you know, you don't want to waste the up space. It's so crucial. And also it's kind of cool to like feel surrounded by plants like you're in a jungle. So I'm trying to complete the glass houses.
Yes. Well, I think it's an important thing. It's the same. Not many shrubs like to be battered by the sun all day long. Some like a lot of sun, but quite a lot of them, like most gardeners. Oh, you must love it in this weather. Yeah, no, not if you're working in it. It's not half. You can't stop every 10 minutes for a nice cold lemonade. But so I think people have got to realise that a bit of shade, it doesn't do any harm at all. In fact,
no, and shade is, and there's differing levels of shade. I think folk always go, I've got shade. But when you look, they've probably got dappled shade for about 4 hours of the day. It feels shady. Quite often, you know, if you come home and your whole garden's in shade, you feel like you've got a shady garden, but actually it's not, and things will thrive in that. And as you say, not everything wants to be in the full, especially if you can't give it water. A lot of crops will benefit from a bit of shade. I benefit from a bit of shade. Your crops are not that different to you. They need a bit of shade.
Because your I'm going to call it the fungi garden, but it's probably got a far posher name.
I've got it in the mushroom beds at the minute.
Because I noticed that does get the nice morning sun. Because I was taking a picture of it on Friday when actually, and I was sitting there thinking, oh, it's too even bright. But that obviously gets shaded more as the day goes on, I guess. Because what's the big tree there? I forgot. Was it a magnolia?
That's a magnolia.
It's a Delevii,
so it's actually evergreen. So it is an evergreen spot. There are places with sun on it. So the Cayley brothers who helped me design that bed have put the mushrooms that are like a bit more sun in the way. We do need to keep it more irrigated, especially that half that does need.
As you look at the left hand side, is going to be more. Yes, because that's going to get no real. Well, there is no escape from the sun until it goes.
No, but not all mushrooms need escape from the sun, you know. No. So they've really chosen ones that will thrive in the different areas. And it's quite a low maintenance bed, actually. It's a lazy man's bed, as we like to say.
I better get myself one put in. Because I know some of the some things you're growing in cages. I mean, we all know shiitake, often there's the doweling pegs you put in. And are they sealed with a, they look like they're sealed with a kind of,
You have to seal things with a wax because wax, if the wild fungi get in, then the wild fungi are always going to be tougher than your kind of cultivated fungi and they'll take over. So, whenever you do a log, Yeah, so you just seal up any holes you make. And the logs will take 2 to 3 years to do. They do take a while. It's a very slow process. But the straw beds and things like that, they've already given us gentle crops. We've had, I would say we've cropped from that bed pretty much every week. Not loads, but like a really nice amount from a shady spot that otherwise we probably wouldn't do anything very much in it. So, you know, I've done it before at my old garden, and I just think that we look at shade and go, oh, what do we do? And I just think everyone should grow mushrooms.
Fair enough. Yeah, because what's the one? Was it hens, something, hen's foot? He was covered up.
Oh, the chicken of the woods and head of the woods.
Chicken of the woods, hen of the woods, that's it. I thought, that's what I quite like, is the wonderful names you get. I'm gauging he was covered up with a taffeta or something. Is he a little bit?
Yeah, they've got a little hat on.
Yeah, he's obviously done a cold.
They've got like totem poles on them. And they've done three logs, and in between each one there's a layer. And we just need to wait for the layer to grow in so that it's a solid structure. So they're kind of hidden away at the minute.
Yeah.
I think it's hen of the woods or chicken of the woods. I think it's hen of the woods.
I think it's hen of the woods.
Yeah, but there's one that's illegal to pick wild. So that's the other thing about growing in your own garden, is that you can grow things that are illegal to pick from the wild. Because although foraging for mushrooms is, you know, it's kind of an old tradition, we can't over forage. So by growing your own and using your shady spots in your garden, I just think it's just a really good solution to what a lot of people see as an issue. And mushrooms are just, you know, they are great healers of the soil, of people. They're great.
They are, and they're quite expensive. If you want your closed cap mushrooms, they're fairly cheap. But you want to buy a shiitake mushroom. A, it's quite hard to find them sometimes unless you go to your other ones. But it's a great way. Just the only thing, like all of those things, is just know your mushrooms, like foraging.
Yeah,
definitely don't go out thinking you can do it with a little guidebook, because it could go very wrong very quickly for you.
No, like if you want to try a mushroom to start with at home, and this is the first one I've grown, King Stropharia, which is a wine cap type, it comes up with kind of a purpley red cap, and there's very little else in the UK that looks like that wild. So it's a really strong kind of starting mushroom. But then you just kind of, you know, ask the experts, you know, but make sure you have a picture of what you're hoping to get to get, because you know, even I nearly poisoned myself the other day. I was like, oh, I was texting Lorraine from the Cayley Brothers, and I was going, is this a pearl oyster? She's like, no, don't eat it, it's come in on the wood chip. So you just got to be like, you know
it's been a pretty bad day for you there, Helena.
It wouldn't have been great, but I always check. If I don't know, I'm really good at my job, but if there's something I'm not sure on, always check. Always check. When you're dealing with food, don't test it by putting it in your dinner. Test it by asking someone.
You know, your students will just go, oh, she's having a sleep in the bed, it must be the warm mulch. She's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, she's gone away. It's fun day Friday. Friday is the fun day Friday for me. And we do all sorts of things. So I sort of, renowned for sort of like finishing things off and doing the fun little jobs. So if she thought I'd just off and away on a mushroom somewhere, who knows? But
she's happy, that's what matters. So what are you looking forward to? Because obviously you're coming into we could call it your first proper season, couldn't we? Because you've had a winter and things like that. What kind of things are you looking forward to doing this year that you couldn't do this year?
I have to say, like all these fruit establishing. So as well as the cordons over the arch, we've got some fan-trained plums that we're going to be training. We've got some pyramid pears, some espalier apples. So I'm quite enjoying watching them develop. It's quite, the first year when you're growing restricted fruit is quite, it's interesting because you don't know which buds are going to, you know, you've kind of snipped them off just underneath where you want them to burst. And, you know, it's quite interesting to see what bursts, and you have to check it really often so that you're like tying them in. So getting the fruit trained will be a really big one.
There's a certain amount of luck in this, there's luck in everything, and you hope, well basically I think your gardeners hope for the best, then you have to plan for the worst. But you know, sometimes it works, and for whatever reason sometimes it doesn't, and there's no rhyme nor reason.
No, so but it's about being vigilant and watching but it's always really fun because you don't know what's going to happen. You know, I don't know whether we're going to have an excessively hot year or wet year. I don't know what's going to come. So I always just enjoy, I mean, I'm at the point where I've got my plans and I know what it should look like. And then I really enjoy the chaos of it starting and it all going, you know, not being able to control it. And
But in another month, I mean, it'll be bang, everything will be going crazy.
Oh, I mean, even just this week with the sun we've had, everything in the glass house, for example, that was growing okay has suddenly gone, yay, there's light, like, let's get away. And
Then they'll go leggy and things like that. And it's like, oh, another problem.
Yeah, lots of sinking of things. But, you know, we're lucky that we don't have any artificial light, but we get enough that nothing's too leggy. We don't start very much yet, really just peppers and some other bits and pieces. But, well, the problem is we only have a very small heat mat. So I have to, like, it's called heat mat Tetris. So you have to kind of get things in on and off before you do the next thing. So we don't have these amazing facilities. We have a kind of, I think it's about 2 meter heat mat. It sounds like a lot, but it's not as much when you've got stuff on it. So actually, the only reason I start things early, such as the peppers, is that I have to get them off so I can get the aubergines on, then the aubergines off so I can get the tomatoes on. Yeah, it's a really good game of Tetris.
It is, and the chosen one gets there. You soon know what your favourites are. This is it. Oh, you've been there for an extra day, have you? Yes.
Yeah, I know.
Don't let me down.
But yeah, so there's not like a rush to start the season, but you work with what you've got. And what I've got is a heat mat that's not massive. You know,
I would love to have your little area in my back garden. I have to say.
I'm very, very lucky with what I do have. I mean, I do have good facilities, but I think folk think that there's like the best of the best. I mean, my glass house actually used to be an alpine house. So it's really well set up for woodland alpines.
Yeah. Yes.
Not veg. But it's part of it. Like, you work with what you've got, and it's gardening, and you can make it work. So, yeah, so my chilies have come up. We're just pricking them out, and then hopefully the aubergines are going in a week or so. And then by the time we chat again, it'll be September.
Well, this is it. And, I've done none of mine yet. I do like watching social media, as they call it. I do like seeing people. I'm thinking, oh, you're going early. I did some cauliflowers and some cabbage, but I've just got a small little greenhouse. I don't want to take up space of it. And they've come up. It's taken them 2 or 3 weeks, but they've finally shown their faces. So I did think that they wouldn't have made it, because we had some pretty hard old frosts a few weeks back.
brassicas are tough as boots, though. Yeah, but that's the other thing, isn't it? It depends on your garden. So as well as having this limited space, the other thing is, I know that we're a bit warmer. We have the wall. Mm. So the wall makes everything about a degree or two warmer. We still don't put anything out very much until May, but we are warmer than, say, you know, I grew up in the north of England or the Midlands, but, you know, it was always cooler. So you work with what you've got. I mean, at home, I live under the Heathrow flight path, which is even warmer. So we actually, it depends on your garden, you know. Whereas just away from me at Kew, there's the grass garden, which is a little frost pocket. So it's not, you know, it's knowing your space, knowing when you can fill it. Like, I can get lettuces outside in March very, very happily. They'll be fine because we don't get any strong frost. She says it might snow now, but they'll live through it. I can't use fleece because the badgers think that's hilarious.
You like the badgers, don't you? You have a fun game with them.
They are.
What's Helena got for us today? Yeah.
They are, because they're just playful. They don't really, they do look for grubs, but they're just very playful, and especially the young badgers. I mean,
some might say destructive when you said playful there. Some might say destructive.
They are destructive, but it is playing. Yeah. I'm trying to get in their minds. But that's why we don't use fleece, because I think they think it's a cake and they run around wearing my fleece and then they tear it to shreds and it's the best game. And then I go and put more on the next night, and it's, you know, so we just don't use fleece.
I tend to find also nature always wins. When people say I try to do this, I tend to think, yeah, but it always wins in the end. You might think you're winning, but you have a night off or something, or forget about it. It always wins. It always wins.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I get people coming in saying they've been trying to grow. For example, we don't grow leeks because my predecessor tried. We get leek moth. We get allium leaf miner. We get all these things. We get rust on them. And at some point, you can't keep fighting all the elements. Just don't grow leeks, because someone else somewhere is going to grow leeks really, really well. So I kind of like, you know, I'll try something once. If it doesn't work, I might try it again. And at that point, there's no point fighting your site, you know. No. Whereas I have such a lovely warm site, I can grow all these kind of lovely tomatoes and aubergines and all these things outside. So put your energy into what your garden does really, really well. Like, don't keep fighting. And, you know, if you've got an animal that just, like, there's a squirrel that has this corner that I think he thinks is his. I don't plant there anymore because, like, what's the point? I know as soon as something goes in, he's going to put his acorns in there instead. So don't fight it. Just kind of go with it and you're going to be much happier in the long
That's
run.
True enough. And he'll be a lot happier. Or she will be a lot happier
or
too.
Or she, yes. Yeah. Whichever gender squirrel it is definitely commandeering the corner.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's just don't fight it because, as you say, we're going to win. Sorry, my screen's just gone funny. There you go. I don't know what's going on. Fight nature.
Mine's trying to tell me to upgrade. I don't know how long you got. I think we've got 5 minutes left on this. I don't know if you've got.
Yeah, I haven't got much longer than that. I've got a group coming in 10 minutes.
Yeah, we're out through a couple of questions. Have you got any tips for growers? Because the readers of Kitchen Garden magazine love a tip.
Love a tip.
Love a tip for their veg.
Trying to think. If you're going to start plants in module like I do a lot, which we do that so that it's a very neat line when you grow it out, you can usually sink a lot of the crops a little bit deeper than the nursery line. So things like courgettes and tomatoes, and if you sink them a bit lower, so the stems in the ground, they actually put out these adventitious roots, which gives, so the stem puts out little roots, so they're more kind of resistant to wind because they've got more roots. They also can find more water and they're just a bit more stable. And if they got a bit leggy at some point, you hide most of the legginess under the ground. So I think don't be scared to, brassicas will do it, all your legumes will do it, and all your cucurbits will do it, and most solanaceae. So it's a bit like earthing up, but you're just planting them a bit lower so that they're more stable in the ground.
Very good, big tick by that then. what do you think will be the, because obviously you experiment with a lot of new veg, yeah. What do you think might be the big new thing in veg growing? I know it's a terrible thing to say the big new thing in veg growing because nothing new has been invented for a long, long time. But what do you think might, as you say, because our weather is changing. So it has opened up opportunities.
So I'm really keen at the minute on, I think I mentioned it earlier, Malabar spinach is a really good one. I think exploring different leafy crops is going to be quite vital, but also it's really fun. So I've started growing... we grow dandelions because they grow really well and they're quite tasty. The chefs like them. Callaloo grows really well now. I've been growing something called minutia, which is basically a plantain, but it's stag's horn plantain, so it's thin and it is one of the most delicious crops. So I think we've got a lot of kind of, we've got to look outside of what we would normally grow in Britain and see what's out there. But also the trend in edible flowers has gone through the roof, which I think is great because as well as being quite tasty, they attract pollinators and they look really nice, which is just great. So yeah, I'm a big kind of advocate of those. I think that's the next step. Who knows with fruit, we probably have different cultivars and, you know, we might see the apricots and peaches are outside more than they were. But it depends. That depends on the winter, so we'll see.
I was about to say, you can always guarantee a late frost put pay to any wonderful things you're hoping for.
Yeah, and who knows what's coming.
Okay, lastly, we've got a couple of minutes left. Tell me all about your new book, Helena.
Cool.
Botany of a Kitchen Garden.
It's Botany of the Kitchen Garden, yeah. And I get asked a lot of questions at Q. And I guess when I started out, there were a lot of books of how-to. There's lots and lots of how-to books.
Yes.
I've written one myself. They're amazing. And every time I read one, you learn something new. But the next step is kind of why. Why are my plants doing this? So it's kind of that answer. It's, you know, I get a lot of people coming in the middle of summer going, why is my Florence fennel bolting, for example? You know, people think it's got too hot. It's got all that. But the actual thing about Florence fennel is that it reacts to day length. So whenever your day length gets to 13 and a half hours, it's going to bolt. It just is. It's its natural way. So therefore, by knowing that bit of information, that botanical bit of information, you can not grow them in July. So you either grow them in March, April, and harvest them by June, or start growing them again in September. So the book looks at kind of why your crops are behaving the way they are, tells you just things that you might not know, like beetroots, we call them root crops, but actually they're mainly made from stem. Since that's sort of next level of kind of understanding the crops, and a lot of the questions I get asked at Q are, why are my crops doing this, not how do I do it? So it's just that next level of information that helps me understand and become a better gardener, really.
Hmm. Lovely. Well, I look forward to getting my copy of it. I hope you have a lovely day. Thanks for joining us on the Grapevine. And
thank you.
And as I say, I'll see you again one day up there.
Yeah, probably the end of the season when we've got some time again.
Yeah, but, well, that's generally the way, isn't it? Yes. Keep your stuff. Thanks very much.
If you've enjoyed this video, press the like button and also give us a comment to let us know what you're doing in the garden at the moment. And if you like our videos generally, it'd be really great if you'd subscribe to our YouTube channel.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.